You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
French President Emmanuel Macron, who is currently isolated, despised, and under pressure from workers who continue to stage protests in the country, has launched a disgusting, brutal, and racist offensive. Macron is targeting the people of Comoros residing in the island of Mayotte, which is one of the four islands of the Comoros archipelago.
After the independence of Comoros in 1975, France illegally remained on the island of Mayotte after conducting a sham referendum. In April, France launched an operation dubbed Wambushu, or Take Back, to clear what it claims are irregular immigrants from Mayotte.
But this brutal operation stalled because the Comorian government of President Azali Assoumani refused to accept the deportees.
As you know, the operation has begun. As we said before, the Comoros are not ready to receive the deported from Mayotte. For this reason, the president insisted on the need for dialogue.
For more on the situation in Mayotte, we have contacted Nabil Aitokash of the Renaissance Party of France and Derek Wendera, a journalist and political analyst in Kampala. Now, French security forces have been tackling what they claim is illegal migration in Mayotte, an island still being colonized by France. Now, let's start off with Mr. Akash. Why did the French government decide to take action against the so-called illegal immigrants in this Comoran island at this point in time?
It's been years and years that previous governments have not dealt with the situation on the island, which is chaos, and we're not really the people of Mayotte really want to again live in peace, and they want action from the government. So we decided to act.
Well, let's now bring in Mr. Wendera. What's your view on the brutal action by the government of France against the people of Comoros in the island of Mayotte?
Thank you for that question. I have been following these matters over the years. As a journalist in Uganda, I think this is not something that is good for humanity, that is good on human beings. I think the authorities would rather use better means to address the problem, which they are calling influx of people from Morocco to Mayotte. But I think they are not handling it well, and that's why many lives, like, you know, have been lost and many people are languishing.
Azali Assoumani, president of the Union of Comoros and the African Union rotating chairman, says he will not accept the forced repatriation by France of around 10,000 people from Mayotte to Comoros. He also says he will not accept financial compensation to take undocumented Comorians from Mayotte.
The president is a political figure, and I know he has all interests for his people. And anything that dehumanizes the people that he leads certainly will cause this kind of tension. And in this case, we are seeing cross-border tensions between France and Mayotte. France and Comoros. And I think Assoumani is right not to accept any kind of monetary compensation, because there's no compensation for life, for instance, for the people that have died so far. And I also think that Assoumani should have taken this this position even much earlier to avoid the predicament of thousands and thousands of people that we have faced.
Campaigners in Comoros have said the operation against the people of Mayotte, which has been approved by the French president, Emmanuel Macron, is a massacre waiting to happen. Activists also blame the government of Comoros for failing to take strong measures to stop the French operation in Mayotte.
I'm very indignant at the reaction of our authorities, he says, because we're forbidden to demonstrate on Operation Wambushu, an operation planned by France, the colonial power, to remove our brothers and sisters from their own land. There are people who would like to demonstrate their discontent, but the authorities forbid it. I really wonder if our authorities are there for us, and if they're there to bring back the Comorian island of Mayotte.
An investigation conducted in 2012 estimated that between 7,000 and 12,000 people had died or gone missing since 1995 while attempting to cross from Comoros to Mayotte.
This made it the deadliest migratory route at that time. More immigrants continue to die at sea due to the French policy of restricting the movement of Comorians in their own ancestral land. Now, Mr. Nabil, human rights activists have termed the deaths a crime and that France is responsible. What do you have to say about this?
We cannot call this a crime undertaken by France. These immigrants take many risks when they try to get to Mayotte. There have been a cooperation with the Comoros in order to prevent the people from Comoros to cross the sea and take those risks.
Now, Mr. Wandera, our guest in Paris says that the government of France is not responsible for the deaths of thousands of the people of Comoros. Do you agree with him?
I think France is indirectly answerable to some of the deaths. And while some of the deaths, France is directly answerable. Because I know that reports provide that there were cases of people from Comoros overloading their boats, the ones they call, I think, quash-quash. They were overloading them, and there are cases of capsizing boats in Indian Ocean. And we don't know, and the reports do not provide what number they were exactly. But also we know that France security forces have been countering people from Comoros from crossing to Mayotte over time. And we know that while countering them, there were cases of shootings, and which might have also caused deaths there. So France is to blame for those deaths.
Mayotte is also a sea of poverty because of the backwardness enforced by French imperialism, which grabbed it in the 19th century. It is also the poorest French overseas department. Most people in the Comoros insist that Mayotte should be freed from French colonialism. Recently, Azali Assoumani, the president of the Union of the Comoros, called for talks with France to discuss the status of Mayotte.
And I hope the French side will take into account the position of the Comorian government on the territorial dispute between our country and France on the Comorian island of Mayotte. We favor the pursuit of new perspectives in order to find a solution to this unfortunate dispute that's lasted for more than 40 years, while respecting international law and the well-understood interests of our two friendly countries.
To you, Nabil, Mayotte is still being colonized by France. Will Paris let it reunite with the Comoros?
Well, in the 70s, the people from Mayotte have voted to remain part of the French Republic, the citizens of Mayotte or French citizens. So there's only one policy in France regarding Mayotte. It's to defend its position within the Republic, is to reinforce its position within our Republic.
Mr. Wandera, you have the last word today. Now, what will it take for the people of Mayotte to be liberated from the shackles of French imperialism and reunite with the Comoros?
It will take unity. It will take people coming together to speak in the same language. It will take leadership of the two countries working together. One of the states or the countries that has been over the years named among those among the countries with the biggest population of migrants or refugees is Uganda, for instance. But if neighbors around Uganda didn't have talking terms with Uganda, then the tolerance and the good conditions that the refugees live with here would have never been it would have never been in place. So I think the people of Mayotte need to address each and every grievance that they have with their leadership there.
Well, I'd like to thank both our guests in this topic, Nabil Ait Akash of the Renaissance Party of France and Derek Wandera, journalist and political analyst in Kampala, for their insight. And that wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today. Goodbye for now.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In Britain, new research has shown that more than a third of people from ethnic and religious minorities have experienced racially motivated assault. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. More than a third of people from ethnic and religious minorities have experienced racially motivated physical or verbal abuse, according to the biggest and most comprehensive survey of race inequality in the United Kingdom for more than a quarter of a century. The survey found strikingly high levels of exposure to abuse across a wide range of ethnic minority groups, as well as a high prevalence of racial discrimination and inequality of outcomes in education, the workplace, housing, and interactions with the police. Britain is not close to being a racially just society, concludes the two-year research project, which urges ministers to tackle what it describes as a substantial ethnic inequality found across a range of areas of British life and British institutions. It says its detailed evidence of discrimination and unfairness directly challenges the findings of the government-commissioned Sewell Report on Racial Disparities published 2 years ago, which it argues downplayed the existence and impact of structural and institutional racism in the United Kingdom. Almost one in six people from minority ethnic and religious groups and backgrounds said they had experienced a racist physical assault prior to the pandemic, according to the survey. This increased to more than one in five Jewish people and more than one in three Gypsies, travellers and Roma people. More than a quarter of all respondents from minority ethnic groups had experienced racial insults, and 17% said their property had been damaged by racist attacks, it found. Nearly a third said they had experienced racism in a public place, and one in six said they had suffered racism at the hands of their neighbours. Nisa Finney, a professor of human geography at the University of St Andrews in Scotland, who led the study, said it showed racism was part of the daily lives of people from ethnic minorities. The United Kingdom is immeasurably far from being a racially just society. The kinds of inequality we see in our study would not be there if we had a really just society. Despite abundant evidence of racial discrimination and unfairness, the survey found the vast majority of minority groups reported a strong sense of belonging to British society, often alongside deep attachment to their own ethnic identity. Many groups reported high levels of trust in the UK Parliament and devolved governments. Such relatively high trust levels were especially striking during the pandemic, when ethnic minorities had a higher than average chance of being infected or dying from COVID-19. With some exceptions, ethnic minority people tended to trust the UK Parliament more than white British people did, the new research has found. Other findings of the new research include nearly a third of people from ethnic and religious minority groups reported racial discrimination in education, 29%, and in employment, 29%, and nearly a fifth said they experienced discrimination when looking for housing. More than a fifth of all minorities reported experience of discrimination from police, though this rose to 43% of Black Caribbean groups and more than a third of Gypsy, Traveller and Roma groups. Ethnic minority groups were more likely to live in overcrowded housing. 60% of Gypsy or Roma families were overcrowded, and a quarter of Pakistani and Arab people, and far more likely than white British people to be without access to outdoor space at home. Halima Begum, chief executive of the race equality think tank, the Runnymede Trust, said their survey data on racialized violence alone was incredibly concerning and disproves the idea that racially motivated hate crime was in decline in Britain. Halima Begum, the chief executive of the race equality think tank Runnymede Trust, said, "Sadly, few ethnic minority Britons will be surprised by the findings of this new research." The Press Association, PA Media, has also covered this story and tells us more. Ethnic and religious minorities in the United Kingdom are suffering strikingly high levels of abuse, according to a major survey into race equality. The research by the Universities of St Andrews, Manchester and King's College London found more than one in three people from minority backgrounds have experienced racially motivated physical or verbal abuse. The study recorded high levels of ethnic minority political engagement. The Labour Party scored highest among Pakistani, Black African and Black Caribbean groups. The Tories gained the highest share of Jewish votes, while the Liberal Democrats got most support from white Eastern European, Chinese and white Irish groups. There was a rise in racist abuse against Chinese and Asian groups during the pandemic, the survey found. Ethnic minority groups were more likely to experience COVID-19-related bereavement than white British people. However, some minority groups were less likely to experience depression and loneliness during the crisis. More than 14,000 people across 21 ethnic groups, including white British, were surveyed between February and October of 2021. The Economic and Social Research Council-funded project was carried out by a team of academics from the Universities of St Andrews in Scotland, the University of Manchester, and King's College London. The research, published in a book, Racism and Ethnic Inequality in a Time of Crisis, this week, offers the most up-to-date and detailed evidence on ethnic inequalities in the United Kingdom, including what its authors say is unprecedented insight into the experiences of Gypsy, Traveller, Roma and Jewish people, produced by the Centre on Dynamics of Ethnicity at Manchester University. It claims to be the most extensive survey of racial inequalities since 1997, offering an unprecedented scale of access, granular detail, and national reach. The survey was co-designed with 13 ethnic minority and community groups.
A quarter century after the fall of the Iron Curtain, never have there been so many politically driven walls in our world. Dividing communities, separating the rich from the poor, and marking borders, walls have become the preferred solution for resolving major conflicts. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. This week's documentary explores how the business of constructing barriers is pursued with ever greater physical, financial, and ideological vigor in the 21st century. From the Middle East to the wealthiest societies of the West, municipal, regional, and international walls have become the preferred means of resolving conflicts and addressing or avoiding civil unrest. Stay with us as we investigate the geopolitics of urban and cultural segregation as seen in Iraq, Brazil, and France.
Just imagine that tomorrow we were to live in private villages behind high security fences. The Mireille neighborhood in Toulouse. 35,000 people live here. From the outside, it's considered a volatile ghetto. The Mireille is dogged by high unemployment and boredom. At night, as a distraction, youngsters noisily rev their engines. This is a public area. Only one association is trying to maintain some sort of law and order, a local group called the Mediators.
Don't hang about here, right under the buildings. Go home. Look at the time. People are asleep now.
Okay, we'll go. Actually, until the Mediators tell us to go home, we hang around outside. Do the residents ever call the police to say they can't stand the bloody noise anymore? Yeah, it can happen. It happens often. They call the police, yeah, sure. We know that because they see that the police won't intervene, so they ask us to help. We get involved, but as you saw, they're on public property, and we can talk to them. Tell them to put their motorbikes away. If they listen, all the better. The police never come here for that sort of thing. Well, if they do, it would be a game of cat and mouse, you know what I mean? In this kind of social housing, they now take care of their own security. They've learned to live without the police. That doesn't bother you? No, it's okay. I've never been scared. She's been here since 1975. Sometimes I go out. I come back at 4 or 5 in the morning. Used to come home and I never had any problems. That means there's a... What about the police? Do they ever come here when you call them? The police? I don't know. I really don't know. But I think it would be worse if they did come. Zubir Saadi was born here, grew up here, and has witnessed the neighborhood slowly change. They've only just got their license as well. I've looked after him for a while now. All he did was stupid things. I saw the mix of people who used to live here. There were whites, Europeans, all sorts of backgrounds. I used to see my parents. They'd go and visit the neighbors. All sorts of different mixes of people. But slowly people began to leave. And we were lucky, because we experienced that kind of diversity. These youngsters don't know that. I was scared, to be honest. There was always so much noise. I saw cars set on fire. But unfortunately, the police would never come, because they'd get attacked. So you felt the estate was left to fend for itself. Yeah, that's right. We'll turn over here. Paulette is one of the middle-class residents that has fled the social housing estates. There, that's it. That last building down there. I used to live there, up on the sixth floor. Do you ever come back?
No.
No. I never wanted to come back. And I never have. Why not? I don't feel comfortable. You see, where I live now, there are just two floors. Here, there can be as many as 15 floors. It's like cages for hens. Paulette moved to a nearby protected estate. There are more of them in Toulouse than anywhere else in France. She now feels much better. We all know each other. We're safe. We can leave the door open. No one can come in. There are no problems. We're not scared of anything. Here we go, this way. Enclosed residences are not necessarily ghettos for the rich. Paulette is a civil servant. That's nice, isn't it? She has a modest salary and a 45-square-meter apartment like all those who live here. With her neighbours, Paulette has rediscovered some of the warmth of the poorer areas. I've got just about everybody's spare set of keys because some of my neighbours are a bit scatty, so you never know. It's very friendly here in this residence. I think it's very pleasant to be here. We're not far from town, and it's a bit like being in the countryside. It's quiet, you can walk around. And there's a pool. It's like a holiday camp. But here, the rules are strict. Even too strict, says Christine, a resident. They've been sending out non-stop things, you know, like notices telling people how to behave, not to make too much noise. I think it's, well, yeah, the rules are a bit strict sometimes. I mean, to ask children not to shout outside. When they need to shout, kids shout. If I hear a kid laughing, I don't think it's a nuisance. That's all. You know, I'm fairly moderate. I don't know. I think it's a bit much. Well, it's not the kids for me, it's the adults. The ones who don't show respect for others, to be honest. There was one person here who wasn't very nice. He made a lot of mistakes. Well, he made noise once or twice. No, he was noisy. I mean, I couldn't sleep once. But my neighbor's camera picked him up. In this small paradise, if you make too much noise, the various security devices will hear you. We're undergoing an urban segregation in this country. Some have recently suggested using the term fragmentation to describe this new kind of town made up of separate parts that have increasingly less in common with each other. So it really marks the end of a kind of society. Yes, it could well be the end of a certain type of society, or in fact a new multi-speed society, a club society, in which the public good is considered like a club. If you can afford it, you pay for membership of the club and benefit from the goods. If you can't, you won't have them. Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, where the economy is booming. The country, though, is cut into two. The middle classes have flocked into enclosed areas, condominiums, entire sectors behind high railings, and armed guards. Brazil is copying Florida with its gated communities, enclosed villages. Right next to the condominiums are the world's largest slums. Two nations, that of the rich and the poor, who live on either side of the ramparts. Thais and her mother always lived in the so-called condominios. Well, the idea for condominios came from keeping people closed off, but with hobbies and things to do, on the inside, there's a bar where you can meet your friends. It's also to be close to each other without needing to go out or risk being attacked. Why? Because the streets are considered dangerous? Yes, yeah, especially at night. And you can't be at the mercy of other people in the streets. Unfortunately, that's today's reality. So they found the way to mix safety with hobbies and pastimes. It's like being outside. In fact, a whole generation is growing up inside the condominiums that will never get to know the real Brazil. It's true. I really think we've created gilded cages. We're prisoners of luxury. I really wish my children were as lucky as I was. I grew up in an apartment block, but we used to play out in the streets. I had that freedom. Today, if I go past the same area where I grew up, I see it's no longer possible. Everyone's a bit more enclosed nowadays. Right alongside the condominiums are the favelas. It's the Brazil of the workers and cleaning women, as well as armed teenagers who live off the drugs trade. They form an alternative kind of justice in these forgotten slums. Shaolin has been in charge of the Residents' Association for a long time. To him, segregation is the worst form of violence. More than the physical wall that separates us, there's the invisible social wall, which is far more hurtful. The superior classes in their buildings, and we, people of no class, in our huts. Right next to each other. The city has to integrate, otherwise there'll be chaos. Directly opposite the huge favela Rocinha on the São Conrado beach are some of the most expensive housing estates in Brazil. They're not just criminals up there. There are some better people up there than they are down here. More honest people. One day, Augusta witnessed a shootout between cocaine traffickers and military police. A scene from a war film. And there was a problem fairly recently between the guys from the Vidigal favela and those from Rocinha. They encountered the military police and there was a fight. They ran off, and in the confusion, they crossed in, went out the other side. That's it. They caused no trouble. They just crossed through. You know, this wall, it's not real security. There are 500,000, 400,000 of them, and just 10,000 of us. If they come down, nothing will stop them. On the other side of the railings, the government decided to seize control of the favelas. November 2010, the army and its armored cars are called in. 4 days of fighting in the north zone eventually forces the traffickers out. The government troops hoist the national colors, a symbol of the victory of one nation over another. Today, Captain Felipe Barreto and his men are on patrol to prevent the gangs from returning. I don't know any city like Rio, with the rich right next to the poor, literally wall to wall. The social impact is very negative. You see down there, where the car is? Before, the police wouldn't have been able to go there. 20 meters away, they'd shoot at you. Just one cop on the corner and they'd open fire. So that was the border? Yeah, that was the border. And what about the other public services? Can they come in? Firemen, postmen, doctors? Well, before, it was only with the permission of the traffickers, so it was a parallel government. Exactly. The media used to call it parallel powers. Are there less now? Oh, yeah. Many were killed. And they fled as well, right? Yeah, all were arrested. Others moved to Rocinha. Rocinha is home to countless thousands of poor. Among them, some heavily armed young men. The traffickers tolerated our presence on their territory so long as we never filmed them. And we were given escorts. One longtime member of the drug world does, however, agree to be interviewed. Nowadays, Regis has stopped dealing. He's settled down, has a family and work, and tries to lead a dignified life. Like most dealers, Regis was also an addict. I took a lot of drugs for 10 years. From the ages of 15 to 26, I hit rock bottom. A lot of cocaine, alcohol. Oh, it lasted for 10 years. I lost my friends, traffickers, thieves. I used to live among all of that. They call me the last of the Mohicans. Why? Because the rest of my generation are all dead. For many of the favela's youngsters, drugs remains the easiest career move. With the intoxicating feeling the street belongs to you. They are arrogant and well-armed, but few will live to see 30. They will be killed by the police or rival gangs. People used to look at me differently. They'd look away when they saw me. My own mother didn't trust me anymore. But thanks to God, I was able to get out of it. Now I have my daughter, my wife, my house and my work. It must be a struggle. Yeah, it is a struggle. But the most important thing is to have abandoned the drug scene. The favelas issue is about successive governments having basically abandoned them. It's just government negligence. That's why we're in the state we're in today. After having assaulted the area, the police tries to do some social work. A community police unit has set up in the middle of the favela, its aim to stop the drug gangs returning. We arrive, we set up, and then we determine what the needs are, and we try and get back into the areas that have been abandoned by the state. Yeah, by the state and by society in general. Captain Barreto's men have established an advance base at the top of the favela. It's a strategic position with a bird's eye view over the condominiums. And Baghdad, the city of 1,000 walls. After 8 years of war, a fragile peace exists behind concrete ramparts. The walls crisscross the city over hundreds of kilometers, causing never-ending detours. Abu Hazem is a taxi driver in the Daura district, which was controlled by insurgents back in 2007. I have to go around the wall, go to the end of the motorway, and come all the way back. It's like a huge prison. It's bad for morale, too. Does the wall make it safer? Does it bring work? Well, in fact, the wall has made it safer. Before, no one could pass here. It was too dangerous. Between 2003 and 2007, Iraq was ravaged by an incredibly vicious civil war. You US soldiers were constantly targeted. Certain areas were completely controlled by the insurgents. Then the Shiite and Sunni militias began killing each other. According to The Lancet, a respected medical journal, 600,000 civilians were killed. That's when the Americans conceived of the idea of building walls around the most violent areas. They would contain the insurrection and separate the Sunnis from the Shiites. Baghdad would resemble Berlin during the time of the wall. The US Army spokesman, however, confirms they are also building gated housing, like the retired people's homes in California.
We're building different walls all throughout the city here, different communities, and you've heard the concept of gated communities.
Mm-hmm. Funny, a gated community, to me, just connotes, you know, an exclusive sort of Coral Gables, Florida kind of setup, which is not what you mean, is it?
The gated communities are designed to protect the population in selected neighborhoods throughout Baghdad.
Many of them don't like it at all. They feel that it will further divide the city on sectarian lines.
Well, the intent is not to divide the city on sectarian lines. Once again, the intent is to provide a more secure neighborhood for the people that live in selected neighborhoods. And if we find areas that we think that the gated communities will do good and will control the population, we'll probably build more.
Each zone is surrounded by a wall. It's like living on a reserve. We're stuck inside. The wall was the Americans' idea. It was American material and vehicles that were used to build it. There never was the split between Sunnis and Shiites before the Americans arrived. Sunnis, Shiites, Christians and Jews, we were all Iraqis first. And the first thing the Americans ask you now is, are you Shiite or Sunni?
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The White House has found another $3 billion for Ukraine aid. U.S. officials previously claimed they overestimated the amount of U.S. aid sent to Kiev by several billion dollars. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted the White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan has offered an explanation for a massive accounting error recently spotted in U.S. assistance to Ukraine, arguing the blunder is actually good news as it means even more American tax dollars can be sent to Kiev. During an interview with CNN's Jake Tapper recently, Sullivan was pressed to explain the Pentagon's bizarre admission that it had found an extra $3 billion in Washington's aid budget for Ukraine, with the host calling it a hell of an accounting error. Asked whether the mistake suggested a lack of oversight on the 37 separate arms shipments and other assistance sent to Kiev since last year, the senior White House official insisted that at the end of the day, not one penny of U.S. dollars will have gone missing or have been misallocated. That is not a waste of that $3 billion. It is simply a tally of how much military equipment we have given them, and the way that the Pentagon was counting it was what's the replacement cost for the equipment we provide rather than just the actual cost of that equipment, Sullivan explained, adding, once you make that adjustment, it turns out we have an additional $3 billion that we can spend to provide even more weapons to Ukraine. He acknowledged the Pentagon should have provided the correct figure in terms of the accounting up front, but argued that U.S. taxpayers can be confident that this money is being spent effectively and appropriately. The admission of the sizable accounting error last week follows repeated criticisms from some Republican lawmakers over U.S. military aid to Ukraine, which has topped $37 billion since the Russia-Ukraine conflict last year. Recently, 19 GOP representatives and senators penned a letter to President Joe Biden urging for an end to the largesse, citing dangerous tensions with Moscow. The lawmakers said they were deeply concerned that the trajectory of U.S. aid to the Ukrainian war effort threatens further escalation and lacks much-needed strategy clarity, adding that there is no end in sight and no clear strategy to bring this war to a close. Despite those complaints, however, most lawmakers continue to back indefinite military aid to Kiev, with the Republican head of the U.S. House Intelligence Committee, Representative Michael Turner, recently declaring that there is overwhelming support for continued assistance within the legislature. Russia has long warned that the military aid, training, intelligence, and other support offered to Kiev has already made the U.S. and its allies de facto parties to the crisis. According to earlier reports, the U.S. Department of Defense has discovered an accounting error that could result in more weapons, ammunition, and equipment being available for Ukraine than was previously expected. Reuters reported recently the agency cited a Senate aide and a Pentagon official, both anonymous, who said that the U.S. military had overestimated the value of some of its hardware that was sent to Kiev by around $3 billion, implying that less money has been spent on arming Ukraine than was previously calculated. The Pentagon used the current replacement cost for equipment taken from its stocks rather than factoring in the original purchase price and depreciation. According to the agency's source, the DOD is reportedly taking steps to notify Congress of the accounting adjustment. Senator Roger Wicker, the ranking Republican on the Senate Armed Services Committee, told Reuters that the Pentagon made a major mistake that could underestimate future needs of NATO allies. Our priority should be a Ukrainian victory. Unilaterally altering military aid calculations is an attempt at deception and undermines this goal, said Senator from Mississippi. However, the accounting confusion may translate into even more supplies to the Kiev government, according to the agency. Recently, the U.S. was reportedly down to only $6 billion in Ukraine aid from $48 billion approved by U.S. Congress in December. Securing more funding is difficult at the moment due to the standoff over the national debt ceiling. Washington's overall efforts to send weapons to Kiev consist of two tracks. The Presidential Drawdown Authority, PDA, allows the Pentagon to send material from its own stockpiles to the tune of $21.1 billion so far in 37 separate packages. The separate Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative, USAI, has the U.S. government pay the military industry to make new weapons and ammunition, much of which has yet to arrive. According to Reuters, the Pentagon sent a memo to the Army, Navy, Air Force, and the Marine Corps on March 31st, clarifying how the value of the equipment should be calculated. The anonymous Pentagon official speaking to the agency used the example of 155mm artillery shells, of which more than 1.5 million were sent to Kiev. While each costs about $800 today, the cost over several decades averages out to much less. Ukraine has repeatedly said its successes on the battlefield heavily depends on the aid from the West. According to Russian military estimates, the U.S. and its allies had delivered over $100 billion worth of weapons and supplies to Ukraine by December 2022. Moscow has warned Washington that this elevates the risk of direct confrontation. However, the U.S. and NATO have insisted that arming Kiev does not actually make them a party to the conflict. According to Axios, it was not immediately clear which weapons had been mistakenly overestimated. The U.S. Defense Department officials were still trying to determine the total overvaluation. The U.S. has in total committed more than $30.4 billion in security assistance to Ukraine since the beginning of the Biden administration, per a Pentagon statement. The website of Hill also reported House Armed Services Chairman Mike Rogers and House Foreign Affairs Chairman Michael McCaul blasted the Pentagon for the mistake. They wrote in a joint statement, "The revelation of a $3 billion accounting error discovered 2 months ago and only today shared with Congress is extremely problematic." The chairman continued, "These funds could have been used for extra supplies and weapons for the upcoming counteroffensive instead of rationing funds to last for the remainder of the fiscal year." While the oversight has led to questions, it also means there are more U.S. dollars for Ukraine than previously believed, as questions mount over whether security aid is drying up. Washington approved $113 billion for Ukraine in 2022, about $47 billion of which is directly related to providing Ukraine with defense needs.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ideal University student, brings change in thinking and reality of the society and world. The following is part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with university students and representatives of student associations in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyah on April 18th, 2023.
The late Musa Kalantari related, "I was sitting in the second or third row of the Friday prayer. Someone was sitting next to me, Matia Baspur, who was one of the ministers and was martyred later, was sitting in the front row. The person who was sitting next to me pointed to Martina Baspur and told me, 'Look, the minister has come and is sitting in the lines for the group prayers. Look where we have gotten to.' It was during the early days of the revolution. Martir Kalantari, who had a beautiful Turkish accent, turned to him and said, 'Let me tell you something that's even stranger. I am one of the ministers too.' They were good ministers. They were good managers. In the military field, we had people like Martir Hemmat, Martir Kharrazi, Martir Babayi, Martir Hassan Baqiri, Martir Shirudi, Martir Ardestani, and Martir Sayyad Shirazi. Of course, Sayyad was older when he was martyred, but he was at the age that I mentioned when he was fighting in the war. These men changed the reality of the war. They turned it into the strength of the Islamic Republic against all the allies of reactionism and arrogance."
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In the field of the arts and literature, there were Martir Murtaza Avini, the late Farajullah Salahshur, and the late Nader Talibzadeh. Of course, they were older when they passed away, but they have done many things at a young age. And there are many others who were like them in the field of science and research. There were Martir Tehrani Muqaddam and the late Kazimi Ashtiani, Martir Majid Shahriari and Martir Rezai Nejad, and Martir Ahmadi Roshan. Our youth are these people. This chain has continued up until today. The contemporary period that you are in, there have been Martir Hujjati, Mustafa Sadrzadeh, Arman Ali Verdi, and Ruhullah Ajamian. They are outstanding individuals. They truly are outstanding figures. There are thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of young, responsible Iranians today. They are the driving force, they are the propelling force of the country and the government's movement, each in a different field. That is how each and every one of you should be.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been guiding me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.